Hey, it's Jackson. I hope you're enjoying these extra podcasts. As much as we enjoyed making them, we certainly have learned a lot about each other over the past few days. But we're going to take a little bit of a different turn. Today, we are going to discuss one of my favorite topics, true crime stories. Now, I have to warn you that this isn't, It's not explicit, like there's no swear words, and it's not overly graphic, but we do discuss murders, and we do discuss the way that some people were murdered in this episode. So if that's a trigger for you, or if you're kind of queasy about that, maybe go back and listen to a couple of the other ones. John talked about How He Met Michael Jackson, and that was great. While we were taping this episode, I forgot to give credit where I got all of my information from. So real quick, this story that I'm about to tell you is the case of the Bloody Benders in Kansas from the 1800s. And I got most of my information, I'll be completely honest with you, from another podcast. It's one of my favorites. It's called My Favorite Murder. It's episode 94. One of my very favorite women, Karen Kilgariff, she does this story and she absolutely kills it. But then she pointed me to an article on Ranker, and Ranker has this really great series of articles actually by a woman named Kat McAuliffe who knows all about the Bloody Benders. So a lot of these details I got from that, and then obviously I filled in the gaps with Wikipedia because where else are you going to find information? So I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed researching it and making it, and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
What's the name of the guy who does the voice of all your those murder shows that you like to watch? Do you know who? The guy, he talks like this.
I mean, there are a few of them, but I don't know any of their names off the top of my head.
There's one guy who's famous.
He's famous.
And he's like this.
That's when they found the murder weapon.
Right. She thought she was going to the restaurant, but instead, she was going to her tomb.
Like bum, that. Bum, bum.
Because I felt like we need to start today's podcast with like a...
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, because today, it's all about murder.
Dun dun.
Reep, reep, reep.
What is that? Law and Order? The Law and Order thing?
Dun 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 dun. I mean, we may as well just sing the intro to all of these.
I can't believe that I gave you that.
Thank you, Monroe. Yeah.
So, for those of you that don't know, I'm a big true crime fanatic. Love stories about just terrible things.
Yeah, it's
I'm
weird.
Fascinated by them, and I've done like. Listen to a lot of true crime podcasts. I've read a lot of true crime books. Like it's something that like my mom and I did together growing up. Like that I just really instilled in me. Like we always were watching 48 Hours or Dateline or 2020 when they were doing murder. I remember specifically we would wake up every morning. I'd get ready for school, and then I would wait in her bedroom while she got ready, and we would be watching the Scott Peterson trial. Where he killed his pregnant wife, Lacey, and we would watch the trial happen in real time on court TV. And we had that on every morning. And so I've been obsessed with this since I was a wee boy.
And you are honestly so excited about it that you get me excited about it.
I can't handle it.
So then I start watching it like, okay, I got to talk to him about this.
So I figured it would be fun for the next couple of days while we're out to do some of my favorite murder stories.
Okay.
Which is also a podcast I listen to, My Favorite Murder.
Right, yeah.
But these really are some of my favorite cases just because they're so crazy. Let's just get into it. So this one takes place in the 1800s. In 1873 in Kansas, George Lonker packed up his home and his infant daughter, Marianne. They were resettling from Independence, Kansas, over to Iowa, and he told his neighbor where he was going and to keep an eye out for a letter. When they landed in the new home, they'd send a letter back saying, hey, we made it. Everything's okay. Because, you know, you can't just text back then.
So did he not have a wife?
I'm assuming his wife died.
Okay.
So he sent a letter back just letting people, like, that was the idea?
That was the idea. It was as soon as he got to Iowa, he was going to get settled. And wherever he landed, then he was just going to send a letter back to his neighbor and be like, hey, everything's cool. The problem is he never got a letter back. They embarked on the Osage Trail, and they would never be seen alive again.
Oh.
And this is the story of the Bloody Benders. Oh, the Bloody Benders.
Oh, my gosh.
All right. So this is just after the American Civil War. We're going to jump back in time a little bit. The U.S. government had moved the Osage Indians from Labette County, Kansas, to a new Indian territory, which eventually would become Oklahoma. So you know that really cool thing where, like, We just kicked all the Indians off their land.
Yeah.
We're like, hey, you go, you live here now. That's where you live. And the reason they were doing this was because we had too many settlers out east, and they were encouraging people to travel west and get a land. You know, the whole, you're going to get 100 acres, settle, build a farm. And they were really trying to expand because they had just, you know, they have all this empty land sitting in the west part of the country.
Like Saratoga Springs.
Yes. You know what? In a little way, like Saratoga Springs. The land was just ripe for the picking. And so the newly vacant land was made available to homesteaders. In 1871, John Bender and his son, John Bender Jr., began construction on a new homestead. They found a 160-acre plot of land adjacent to the Osage Trail. Now, at the time, the Osage Trail was the farthest west road you could travel. It was the only highly traveled road from the East Coast out west.
So Route 66 for back in the days of yore.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. So this is like if you were settling these western territories, you had to take the Osage Trail because there was no other way to go. So needless to say, it wasn't exactly a Starbucks on every corner.
Yeah.
Getting provisions was really difficult because as you were coming along, if you didn't have what you had, you had to just deal with whatever you had on hand. You couldn't just drop by a 7-Eleven and get, you know, food and water or whatever.
Look, I played Oregon Trail.
You know.
I get it.
You know. Dysentery.
Dysentery.
Et cetera.
That's
the thing. Like, if you got dysentery, you just died on the trail.
Yeah.
If your horse went lame, you just sort of had to walk and hopefully someone would come along.
And you died on the trail.
Or you would die on the trail. Right. Usually you ended up dying on the trail.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons that George Lochner was really specific with his neighbor. Like, when I get to Iowa, I'll send you a letter so that you can tell everyone that I got there and everything's okay.
Okay.
Because, you know, there's a chance that he was going to die on the trail.
Right.
So they got a really prime spot of land. They dug a well. They built a cabin. They built a barn. And they turned the cabin into a general store. So their cabin, they took the canvas off of their covered wagon, and they used it to divide their cabin in half. So one half is where the Bender family lived, and the other half was a general store where you could go and you could get some provisions. It was also an inn, so you could leave your horse and your stuff in the barn, and then you could stay the night in the general store in case you needed just some shelter and you needed some reprieve from the cabin. And then once that was all done, they sent for the other half of their family. The other half of their family was John Sr.'s wife, Elvira, and John and Elvira's daughter, Kate.
Okay.
So they sent for the women. The women came out. They weren't exactly the hit of the neighborhood. John and Elvira had a difficult time communicating with their neighbors because they were immigrants, possibly German, maybe Dutch. There are conflicting reports.
Okay.
And they spoke little to no English. One of the stories that I found said that John spoke, when he did, he spoke so gutturally that it was usually unintelligible. So he would just grunt instead of speak. Elvira Bender made quite the reputation for herself. She was 55 years old, spoke little to no English at all, and was so unfriendly, the neighbors just started calling her She-Devil.
Oh my God.
So.
All right.
John Bender Jr., he was 25 and he was hot. Like that was a report that was going around. John Bender Jr., that hot 25-year-old living up on the Bender farm, he spoke English really fluently, but he had a German accent. The thing about John is that he was prone to having sudden fits of laughter. So he would just be staring out into the field and then he would just bust out into laughter. And everyone's like, oh, he was a halfwit.
Oh, yeah.
Which back in the day before we like knew of any sort of mental illnesses or anything, mm-hmm. where you were either right or you were stupid.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that was just the two classifications. So everyone just thought he was some hot idiot. imagine the Ryan Lochte of the Osage Trail back in the 1800s. Now, Kate Bender is really fascinating. Kate Bender is the younger daughter. She was 23 at the time. They called her cultivated and attractive, so she was well-groomed. She really presents herself well, and she spoke English with almost no accent at all. She spoke very well, very good English, unlike me, who obviously can't speak very well English. She was a self-proclaimed healer and a psychic. So she made these flyers that she would distribute around the local townships, and she said that she has supernatural abilities and powers that could cure any illness, including, quote, blindness, fits, deafness, and drunkenness. So if you're an alcoholic,
John.
So she was part of an MLM, is what it sounds like.
No, because she wasn't recruiting other people.
Oh, it was just
her. Was just swindling people. She was a good old-fashioned like snake oil doctor.
I like that.
So she would be like, hey, if you're blind or you're deaf or you're an alcoholic, come to my farm and I will cure you with my supernatural healing abilities. She claimed to have powers over evil spirits that caused these diseases.
Wow.
Again, this is the 1800s where evil spirits just kind of, they caused everything.
Yeah.
Miss Cleo.
Exactly. So she also conducted seances and gave lectures on spiritualism. So in the towns nearby, she kind of built a reputation for herself as being like, if you want to talk to a dead relative, which was really popular back then because there was no Netflix. Like there was just nothing to do but talk to ghosts.
Yeah.
So they would go to the Bender farm and they would have Kate do seances and stuff. She became quite the attraction for the Benders Inn. So imagine this. You're an immigrant. Traveled for months on a boat, you get to New York, you find out you can get 100 acres of land if you push west, you've been traveling forever, you're thirsty, you're hungry, you're covered in sores and dirt, and you come to this place where there's a guy that just grunts at you, the unfriendliest woman in the world, a ghost whisperer, and a guy who just busts out into fits of laughter. But you can't stay anywhere else. That's the only place for miles that has any sort of provision. So you go into these people who are straight out of a horror novel.
Yeah.
I was just thinking The Hills Have Eyes.
Yes. Exactly. And you just kind of have to stay there because it's the only place you can stay and you haven't had a can of beans in 3 days.
Right.
Or whatever it is that they're eating. I don't know what they're eating. It's unfriendly. To say the least. So around the time that the Benders moved in another part of town, this is called Drum Creek, which is not very far away from the Benders Inn at all, a man was found dead in the creek. After they retrieved the body, they found that the man's skull had been crushed and his throat had been slit. So it was an obvious murder. It wasn't just an accident. Authorities had initially suspected the owner of Drum Creek, but nothing ever came of the investigation. And the following year, two more bodies were found nearby, having been murdered in a very similar manner.
Now, were these bodies, were they townspeople or were they outsiders who were being
found? So here's the thing. On this trail, like I said, it was a lot of immigrants coming west.
Okay.
So it wasn't locals.
It wasn't locals.
They were people that these people didn't know.
Yeah, just random bodies.
Yeah. And they were people that you wouldn't, no one was looking for these people.
Right.
Because once you left the old country, wherever that might be, like you said goodbye to your family forever, and maybe 18 months later you'd receive a letter, or maybe you didn't, but you weren't expecting anything back.
Right.
You knew that that would be the last time you saw your loved one was when they made it over to the new country. So these people just start disappearing, and no one really knows why or who they are or what they can do to help. By 1873, disappearances in that area had become so common that locals and travelers referred to it as the land of horse thieves and villains. It is such a problem that locals started a vigilance committee. So basically what was happening is along the trail, homesteaders would say, oh yeah, there was a really nice Dutch guy or whatever. He came into my town and hung out for a little while. He was real nice. And then the next town over would be like, oh, well, he didn't make it to my town. And so they're like, oh, well, what happened to that Dutch guy? They just didn't know what was going on or what was happening to
right.
these people. And, of course, they suspected the Indians because it's always the Indians' problem. They're always killing people.
Right.
We like to blame things on them all the time. The Vigilance Committee is basically like a neighborhood watch on steroids. The committee, quote, arrested because they're just a group of people hanging out. They're like, I don't like the way this looks.
It's like a mob.
Yeah. So they started arresting people for these disappearances, even ran a few people out of town claiming that they were the ones causing these disappearances. And even though they arrested people and ran people out of town, the disappearances continued to happen. All right. Now we're going to go back to my friend George Lonker from the very beginning of the story. Remember, he packed up his one-year-old daughter. They left Independence, Kansas for Iowa in the winter of 1972. By the way, who's moving in winter?
I was just thinking that myself.
What? And I've said 1972, 1872. Right.
Either way, you don't go anywhere in the winter. I don't care if it's 2072.
You
don't do things in the winter.
In the winter.
Right.
I know. Especially when you have like a horse and buggy.
Yes.
How are you staying warm?
And your shoes are burlap sacks.
That's all. Or something.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, so they move, which is crazy, but maybe that's another reason he was so clear with his neighbor, expect a letter from me.
Got it.
So the following spring, Longcur's neighbor, Dr. William Henry York, started to worry because he hadn't received a letter yet. He's like, oh, my buddy said he was moving to Iowa and that we'd get a letter back. He hadn't received anything. So he retraced George and Marianne's route, asking homesteaders along the way, hey, did you see a couple months ago a guy and his young daughter? They were traveling through.
Wait, so this guy, after remembering about his neighbor a year later, which I can't remember coworkers who worked here 6 months ago.
That's true.
He then started wandering the same path as the last guy.
Yeah, he went out to find him.
What a good person.
Yeah. I know. They were really tight.
We were really cold back in the day, but we were also really nice.
Yeah.
Oh, I think we were way nicer back then. Like, you had this type of relationship with your neighbor was not uncommon. It was also common for, if you were a stranger coming into town, that's why he had such an easy time walking in all these homesteads, like, hey, did you see a guy and his daughter?
Yeah.
They're like, oh yeah, a few months ago. I'm pretty sure, because like it was when you had strangers come in, you didn't just ignore them like we do now.
It was a big deal.
It was a big deal, and you like got to know them, and they would come into the saloon, and you'd have a drink or whatever. So it was weird that all of these homesteaders were like, yeah, we saw him, but he didn't get his letter. So, let's see. Move to the winter. Retrace the steps. Okay. We know that he made it to at least Fort Scott, which is 100 miles away from where he started. He traveled 100 miles to Fort Scott looking for this guy. And eventually the trail must have gone cold because he turned back and started his journey back to Independence where he lives.
Yeah.
And he never made it back home. He never made it back home.
So you're telling me both the original person and
then
the
George
nice
Longcur
neighbor.
And his daughter Marianne never made it home. And then Dr. York also never made it home
aliens.
After he turned back around.
It's aliens.
It's aliens.
It's aliens.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, you think that.
I'm just saying, I can feel it. You're going aliens.
Yeah. Luckily, Dr. York had two very powerful brothers who were not messing around. So his brother, one of them was a military colonel. The other one was a Kansas state legislator. He was a senator.
Okay.
So the senator and the colonel are like, my brother disappeared. He told us where he was going. He told us when to expect him back. He never showed up. So the colonel rounds up 50 men to retrace his brother's steps.
Man.
So now it's a complete manhunt trying to track down their missing brother. They were not messing around. 20 days after Dr. York's disappearance, the colonel and some of his men landed at the Bender's Inn. They admitted that they had seen Dr. York and that Dr. York and his daughter had stayed with them, but after he left, they probably had some run-ins with the Indians. Again, we like to blame the Indians for everything. Colonel York agreed that it was possible, remained for dinner, stayed the night. So he gets up the next day, goes out, continues the search. On April 3rd, so we're a couple weeks into this disappearance, Colonel York returned to the inn with armed men and was informed. So as he's out canvassing these other neighborhoods, he was like, did you see anything? The last time they were seen was at the Bender's Inn. And this woman was like, oh, they were at the Bender's Inn. You should be terrified. And they were like, why? And she said that she went over to the Bender's Inn to have Kate do some healing.
Okay.
And Elvira ended up chasing her out with knives.
What?
The scary she-devil mom
chased
her away with knives. She said the woman, so they went back and they were like, Elvira, I'm here with my armed men. Why did you chase this woman out of your house with knives? Elvira said that the woman was a witch who cursed her coffee and ordered all of the men to leave her house. She goes, I was going to stab her because she cursed my coffee. And you need to leave, please.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, again, the 1800s.
Different time.
You can get away with saying things like that.
Right.
So they leave for a second and they all were walking away and they're like, did she just speak perfect English?
Wait, what?
She-Devil didn't speak English at all, allegedly. But when they kept pressuring her, asking her why she was chasing this woman away with knives, she lost her temper and was just like, get out of my house, in a perfect English.
You know what's sad? I would never notice that. I am not aware enough.
Right.
Yeah, like if someone had a bad accent and the next moment just spoke normal English, I would just be like, oh, cool. Like that would never dawn on me.
Yeah. Before the men pack up and leave the house, Kate pulls Colonel York aside and says, hey, why don't you come back on Friday? By Friday, I'll have done some clairvoyant work and I will have an answer to you as to where your brother is. So she's going to spend the next couple of days using her powers to find his brother.
Sure.
So Colonel York decides, all right, we'll just come back on Friday. Elvira will hopefully be calmed down by then. So they're walking away. The men are like, it's weird that Elvira just speaks English all of a sudden. And they were convinced then and there that the Benders were guilty of the disappearance, and they wanted to go back and hang the whole family. Because, again, the
1800s.
Yeah. Just crazy out there. Yeah. The colonel, however, wanted more evidence. So he started interviewing all of the Benders' neighbors. He even had a town hall with their vigilance committee and everyone else. And he just basically was like, who here thinks the Benders are weird? And the towns came out in droves. Dozens of people showed up, and they're like, well, there was that Dutch guy who came by my farm, but then he didn't make it to this farm, and we thought that was weird, and the Benders' farm's in between our farms, and so they started piecing together a story, and they came to the conclusion that they were, in fact, guilty. And so they decided, you know what, let's go back on Friday because they'll be expecting us. We'll go in, we'll start talking with Kate about her clairvoyant powers, and then we'll arrest the Benders because obviously they're guilty of making people disappear. Well, when they returned back to the Benders' farm, it had been completely abandoned. John Jr., Elvira, and Kate had completely disappeared, and they had left all of their animals to starve. So they had showed back up to the farm. All the animals are dead. They didn't know what to do, so they just start searching the cabin, and that's when the real horrors of what the Benders had been doing were revealed. After an investigation of the cabin, authorities came to the conclusion that when someone stopped at the cabin to eat or purchase supplies, they would sit them down at this table, and remember that big canvas that they took off their covered wagon and used to separate their private residence from the general store?
Yeah.
Well, they would have someone sit at the table with their back to that canvas, and then either John or John Jr. would grab a hammer and smash them in the back of the head while they sat there.
Oh, gosh.
But then Elvira, who is real into knives, mm-hmm. would slit their throat to make sure that they were dead. So they had all of these people that no one was looking for. They just got in bad luck with Dr. York.
Yeah.
They thought he was just another wary traveler. They were doing this to a ton of people. They were smashing them. The craziest part is once they were dead, they had built a trap door in the bottom of their cabin that they would open up, and it opened up into a cellar, and they would drop the bodies down there.
So they were just disposing the bodies in the cellar?
Well, you would hope that that's the case.
Oh, no.
Because what they would do is they would stash the body down there, and then they would wait until night fell, and they would go bury it somewhere on the property when the neighbors weren't gonna come across them.
So were they just like robbing these people? Is that why they were doing
it? Yeah. So, okay. Well, yes and no. So when they dropped them down to the cellar, they would go down, they would remove the clothes and anything of value, wait for night, bury the body. And so a lot of people are like, oh, well, they were just robbing these people, and that's horrifying and gross, but that's not. But then there are reports that there were a couple of people that they got nothing but 15 cents off of.
Mm.
And it turned out that they just enjoyed killing people. So it's this family of murderous people.
Jeez.
Yeah. When they opened up the trap door, in order to go investigate it, no one wanted to go down there. It reeked of death.
Yeah.
They couldn't get down into the cellar. So what they did is they had a group of men pick the cabin up and move it over so that they could look down into the cellar without having to actually go down into it. And there was no body, just a bunch of congealed blood. So they were like, all right, that's reason enough for us to start digging up their whole farm. So they start digging up the farm. This is so crazy. So they start digging up the farm, and they used a metal rod to go look for depressions. So this is old school forensics. Before we had any sort of x-ray or radar technology, they would just use a metal pole to go stab into the ground. And if the ground was really soft, it meant that it had been recently disturbed, or if it was softer. So they're like, okay, well, that's a point of interest. So they marked all these points of interest. They ended up, and then night had fallen, so they had to wait till the next day. They ended up finding 9 suspected grave sites, and when they dug them up, 7 of the 9 suspected graves had bodies in them.
Wow.
And then there was an 8th grave that just had a bunch of body parts. No specific body. There were at least 12 murder victims, but it could have been as high as their 20s.
Wow.
They discovered the body of Dr. York, who had gone missing. The colonel was like, they killed my brother. Here's the worst part. Now, this has all been pretty gross, but this is the worst part. So if you don't like, If kid things worry you and you don't like that sort of thing, fast forward. Oh, just man. Hit the forward 30-second button. John, you have to sit through it.
That sucks.
They found the body of George Lonker, who had gone missing with his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And underneath that, they had found the body of his daughter.
Aww.
But there were no injuries to his daughter.
Oh, no. They just buried her alive.
They buried her alive.
Oh,
they
God.
Threw her in the grave. They put her dad on top of her.
Oh.
And they buried her alive.
Oh, that's terrible.
Isn't that horrifying? So after abandoning the farm, here's the worst part. The Benders were never seen again.
Wait, they never got caught?
They never got caught. Despite various sightings and even arrests of people who were later determined to be members of the murderous family, nobody actually got caught. Now, here's the craziest part. It was believed that after they did some record searching, they never found a family through all of these immigration records named the Benders. They did, however, find John Bender's name, and he arrived here by himself. So, and then the rumor started coming out from all over the town that John Jr. and Kate weren't actually their son and daughter. They were a married couple.
Mm-hmm.
So the common belief is that somewhere when they got to America, these four people found each other. So John and Elvira were actually husband and wife.
Okay.
But John and Kate were just another couple. And they were like, hey, we're old enough to be your parents. Do you want to become our kids? And then we'll just rob a bunch of people. And they kind of hatched this plan, and they came out here and were wildly successful with it. Because between the general store and the robbings and the supernatural abilities and all of this, they made a fortune. They made a huge fortune, and they just bailed. And no one knows to this day whatever happened to the Benders.
Wow.
Great story, Jackson.
Isn't that crazy? As of right now, the site where the cabin is built, no one has ever built on top of it. It is a completely abandoned field.
Huh.
It is known as Hell's Acre. And people like me go and they visit Hell's Acre because they don't know how many bodies could actually have been buried on the property.
Right.
They think it's super haunted. They would go bury these bodies out in the apple orchard. So I like to think that maybe there's just like super haunted apples in that
right.
apple orchard.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. But yeah, Benders were never found.
Interesting.
My mind is blown.
Isn't that bonkers?
Yeah, it is.
Isn't that crazy?
It's insane.
Yeah.
Maybe they never had accents, so they leave. Then all of a sudden you just don't talk in the accent anymore.
And then,
it's like Unusual Suspects.
I like to think that I think John and Elvira probably did have an accent because, well, Elvira maybe not, but John, like, he's just like, blah.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, so down the road 5 miles, blah, blah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, it's not like Jabba the Hutt.
They were also quirky, so you think they would kind of stand out, like, wherever they went.
Or were they, man? Who knows?
Maybe Elvira was the mastermind, though. She had a dummy husband.
Well, Kris Jenner.
Yeah.
And the thing about it too is that John Jr. and Kate, they like John Sr. and Elvira, they were complete shut-ins. They didn't have anything to do with their neighbors, which was really weird at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But John Jr. and Kate would go into town and they like Sunday church school and everyone's I mean, they're quirky, but they're not weird. They don't seem dangerous. They just seem he seems stupid and she seems like she's really into ghosts, which at the time wasn't weird. It was kind of accepted.
Gosh.
Yeah.
Right.
So they probably didn't move somewhere and didn't make a splash.
Next time they redo Oregon Trail, they need to put that house in there.
The Bender family.
The Bender family.
I want to believe that somewhere in Red Dead Redemption 2 that I haven't discovered yet, there's a Bender-ish family.
There you go. That's Jackson's murder story.
Murder!
We'll have another one tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the podcast.